Should America become a big oil exporter? Marketplace is listener-supported. I know that just goes in one ear and out the other, but it means it is supported by listeners like you. So to keep our coverage compelling, up to date, up to the minute, if you can, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount will support your daily dose of business insight from us. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. You can donate by going to marketplace.org by the end of the year, December 31st. Thanks. From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. The controversial technique of hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, has made the U.S. into the world's top oil and gas producer, but it's still illegal in most cases for energy companies to export crude oil. Exxon has just become the latest oil company to say it's time for the U.S. to lift the ban on exports, but what might that do to prices for consumers? Marketplace's Dan Weissman has been taking a look at the export ban. Hello, Dan.
Hi, David.
First, let's go back a step. Does the U.S. have a surplus of oil?
Well, yes and no. The U.S. still imports more oil than it produces. So you'd think we wouldn't need a ban on exporting oil. Markets would just take care of that. But turns out the places where oil is being produced in the U.S. are actually closer to foreign markets than domestic ones. So, you know, West Texas booming next to Mexico, North Dakota pumping out oil next to Canada. Meanwhile, U.S. refineries that are ready to handle that oil, they're farther away. So there's a kind of a bottleneck, kind of a surplus. So it could be more efficient to ship that oil to our neighbors.
But here's a key question for consumers. Would exporting oil mean we would see higher prices for gasoline and heating oil here?
Yeah, you know, it seems like that would make sense. It's not entirely clear. You know, here's the context. The ban dates back to the 70s. Arab countries declared a big oil embargo. Our economy took a huge hit. And the export ban was a response to that. But, you know, that was then. I talked with Simon Wardell. He's an energy analyst at IHS. He says now oil is easy to move around the world. The price really gets set globally. And so for now, he thinks we can get whatever we need on that global market. And he says price isn't an issue. And, you know, by the way, if there was a new threat to imports, we could just have an export ban again. And it's not just oil companies saying it's time to reconsider. The Council on Foreign Relations published a memo last summer saying the same thing.
Marketplace's Dan Weissman in Chicago, thank you very much.
Thanks,
David. And staying on the fossil fuel beat here, this time a health and safety angle. This month, federal regulators are expected to come out with new rules covering the disease known as black lung. The Department of Labor, which is writing the new requirements, won't disclose details yet. But as Sally Herships reports, miners say tighter restrictions can't come too soon, with about 1,000 miners dying of the disease each year.
The initiative to end black lung launched in 2010, and coal miners today?
These men are reporting, and you know, the dust is so thick you can't see in front of your face.
Timothy Bailey is a West Virginia lawyer. He represents miners with black lung.
Not only are we seeing more advanced cases, but we're seeing the advanced cases in younger coal miners.
Bailey says as we run out of pure sources of coal, miners breathe in more rock dust than they used to. But there haven't been many changes to rules about dust in mines since 1969. Dr. Edward Petzong teaches pulmonary medicine at West Virginia University.
It's clear that the science that was used to set the original standard wasn't quite as accurate as it could have been.
Dr. Petzong says the amount of dust, as well as its toxicity, must be increasing. But the National Mining Association, which represents companies, says problems only exist in some states, so it doesn't support tighter rules industry-wide. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
One can be cynical about year-end resolutions that often don't make it into February, but there are ways to optimize some of the personal finance promises that you make to yourself, which is a fine reason to bring in personal finance expert Carmen Wong Ulrich, host of Marketplace Money, one of the other programs in the family here. Hi, Carmen.
Hello, David.
A lot of resolutions tend to involve personal finance.
Oh, not just tend. The number two or number three resolution almost every year, year in and year out, is money-related.
Now, you showed me this list of common resolutions, and one of the ones that stood out for me was live life to the fullest. In 2014, I'm going to live life to the fullest. And there's two ways to look at that. Either I'm going to spend all my money because I may not live to 2015, or it might mean get one's finances in order so I have the money to do some of this.
Oh, my gosh. Listen, when I see that one, all I think about is that awful YOLO thing that you only live once. And what that usually means is let me go spend myself silly. Where is the value for you? Because if it's always in the things and spending money on things, you ain't going to find it. But if it's in the experiences, then you'll probably be more likely to have it.
But you're making an important point here, which is we're going to fall down on these resolutions by March 15th if we don't have a really clear sense of why, for instance, we're going to save starting in January.
Yeah, here's the thing. If you want to make your resolutions to stick, one of the key things to do is to make them very concrete. So let's say you're saying, I'm going to save up $1,000 this year. How long do you want to give yourself to save that money? The full year? 6 months? Are you paying it for vacation? And you got to make sure to have those goals in place.
I got a short-term resolution here, which is get your receipts in order to wrap up the tax year. That also happens this time of year, right?
That really does. And, you know, here's what I do. And this only works if you don't have trouble with spending. I use a credit card that I can track and tab every expense and categorize it. So at the end of the year, instead of gathering receipts, I simply head online and say, okay, how much did I spend on transportation, restaurants, this, that, subscriptions? And it all comes out right there and it's easy to do. If you don't have a system this year, put it into place for 2014.
Carmen Wong Ulrich, host of the public radio show here, Marketplace Money Tweets at Live Money. Carmen, have a great holiday.
You as well, David. Thanks for having me.
And avoid the hassle of snowshoes, and who even owns a hatchet nowadays? Bloomberg News reports the most common way to get a Christmas tree in America is Home Depot. And if you're utterly immune to nostalgia, you can go online in many cities to order a real tree home delivered, but that's just 3% of sales. What I'm going to do is look for mine used on eBay, vintage 2012 tree, slight fire hazard. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.